From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Should you be charged with a crime in North Carolina, even if you had no reasonable way of knowing that what you did was wrong? If you said no, you'll want to learn about reform of something called mens rea. It's a Latin term for guilty mind. Not every crime requires it. Some members of Congress want to create a new border adjustment tax. You'll learn why retailers and consumer advocates in North Carolina are fighting the idea. They say it could cost the average family an extra $1,700 per year. Redistricting reformers continue to push for change in the way North Carolina draws its election maps. You'll hear from Republicans and Democrats who support the change. And we'll discuss national recognition for some of North Carolina's highest performing schools of choice. They make up the state's five best high schools, according to one major national magazine. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Large-scale solar energy projects are now cropping up across North Carolina, replacing cropland with panels that can be several miles long and wide. Now, the industry is boosted by a state law that requires North Carolina utilities to buy a growing percentage of their power from so-called renewable sources. But some officials are starting to push back. The Currituck County Commission has now imposed a moratorium on solar farms, following the opening of a giant MIT farm. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal, and of course, Carolina Journal, following this story of the solar industry in our state very, very closely. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
So why is Currituck County saying they've really had enough of solar?
Mainly because the projects have gotten so big. The one that in particular that we have focused on is one that is operated on behalf of MIT, and this one covers 650 acres. If you go to our story at carolinajournal.com or see the print edition of the story, you will see how large it is. You will see that it dwarfs nearby houses. It's a massive, massive project, and neighbors there consider it to be a nuisance. For one thing, the project itself, the people who constructed it were not responsible for building any kind of barrier around it. You might want to plant vegetation or something like that to block it from the view of passersby. Well, there's nothing like that there. And there are also concerns about when the project was constructed, you were clearing all this land. You were not putting up anything again in its place. And so you had issues with vermin, with snakes, with other sorts of things, with possible damage to the water system. I mean, all these sorts of things were just not accounted for when the solar farm was authorized.
So the commission then said, okay, we don't want to see these in our county anymore,
right,
because of all these issues that you brought up. And also, as Carolina Journal has been reporting, some of those neighbors who actually do live right next to this are none too happy about it either.
That's right. They say that what's happened is that it has damaged their property values. Again, that there's a possibility of health concerns from potential groundwater damage, because before this was grassland. This was your basic it may have been used for farming. It may have just been used for open space. But anyway, there was vegetation there. There were ways to sort of offset problems if you have big rainstorms or something like that. Now you've just got these solar panels sitting on bare ground.
How prevalent are these types of solar farms in North Carolina?
The only one that's in major operation right now is one that we've reported about before, which is the Amazon. That's not a solar farm. There are solar farms all over the state. Excuse me, I was thinking about another project. But there are solar farms all over the state. This is the largest one, and this is the only commercial level one of this magnitude. But there are some in almost in very many counties. It could be as small as a residential solar farm. It could be something that's being used, you know, ostensibly to power or to provide some energy for, let's say, a server installation for one of the big companies like Apple or Google. Or it could be something that's used I mean, you'll see these in places in which they will have a solar farm that's used to provide electricity for the grid that's supposed to help power a school or something like that.
So small, medium, large, right. but they are becoming more and more prevalent. Is that because they're subsidized?
That's entirely because of what was known as the time of Senate Bill 3, which was a provision passed 10 years ago that will require utilities to eventually generate upwards of 15% of all their electricity from renewable sources. They're currently, I believe, at 6% for this. And what the utilities have to do is either purchase 6% of their total output from renewable sources, and that includes solar, wind, also includes hydroelectric. So that's part of it. Or to save 6%, to use energy efficiency methods. This is sort of the cheater's way around it. Is what you do is you say, well, we could have this really awful, you know, this really awful coal plant that produces all this pollution. We're going to replace it with a natural gas plant, which produces less carbon emissions. And so that's going to count. That offset counts. But, the percentages are ratcheting up year by year. And, so because of that, and also because of various subsidies that have been granted to offset the production costs and the land costs of these facilities, then that is now a viable industry in North Carolina.
One of the reasons that these are more and more prevalent and cropping up in different counties is that you have big organizations, and I think MIT is one of them. They say, look, we want to reduce our so-called carbon footprint.
Right.
So they're going to get involved in something that is a renewable energy source. But as I understand it from the reporting that Don Carrington has been doing on this story at Carolina Journal, that facility actually doesn't hook up to the grid that would actually be on the grid that MIT would be using electricity from, right?
That's right. The power from this facility goes on the grid that's operated by a subsidiary of Dominion Power, and that grid covers the mid-Atlantic states. Now, MIT gets its power from a grid that covers the northeastern states. In fact, a lot of its energy it gets from a natural gas-producing plant that's located right on the campus, and then it purchases the rest from the local utility. But what MIT is doing is they're essentially saying, we're producing this green energy here in North Carolina, and because we're producing this green energy and putting that on making that power available to consumers in eastern North Carolina and southeastern Virginia, therefore we're offsetting all the bad stuff we're doing from the power that we're using in Massachusetts.
That's a real head scratcher because it seems as if maybe that's a noble cause, mm-hmm. if they think that's important to do, but they're not actually reducing their energy use.
No, they're not. And this is, you know, Al Gore used to talk about offsetting his carbon footprint. So he would jet around the planet in these planes that were doing terrible things to the environment. But what he'd also do is he'd make his whole house green. So because his house was not consuming as much energy, that's offsetting the bad stuff that he's doing when he's jetting around the planet, telling people how awful global warming is. So, I mean, that's part of what's going on. And another reason that these facilities are popping up is because in many cases, the people who own the property do not actually use the property. They may be absentee owners who have the option of leasing it to someone to farm or leasing it to someone to put a solar farm up. And it turns out that solar operations get an 80% local property tax rebate. So again, there's another taxpayer-funded incentive for someone to use the land in a way. I mean, the landowner doesn't care whether you're growing tobacco or cotton or corn or you're producing solar energy. They want the best return for their money, and the best return they're getting is not a market return, but a government subsidized return. And so that's another reason why a lot of these facilities are popping up around the state.
And because of everything that you've just described, there are some state legislators who are thinking that this is not a very good deal for taxpayers.
Right. There are several legislative vehicles that are active right now, different laws in House and Senate that would stop the growth of this renewable energy mandate that might freeze it at 6%, might let it go to 8, but certainly would try to get it down below the highest level, which right now looks like 12.5 is what they're really shooting for, but at least try to cut that off so that people can sit back and figure out some way to see if this is really the best way to produce low-cost, reliable energy for North Carolinians.
And then if that were to happen, the interesting thing would be to watch what happens to the industry. Does it kind of pare itself back because it has to actually compete in the marketplace without that subsidy? I think that's the big question mark.
That's right. Exactly.
And Carolina Journal, of course, will be reporting on all of these updates on the solar industry in North Carolina. We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Does it make sense to charge someone with a crime if he had no reason to believe that his conduct was wrong? That question lies at the heart of efforts to reform North Carolina's rules regarding the Latin term mens rea. It's a topic that led to a recent forum at Campbell University Law School, and one of the experts who addressed the issue joins us now. Joe Lupino-Esposito is a policy analyst for Right on Crime and the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into mens rea, remind us, Right on Crime is a group that focuses on criminal justice issues nationally, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So we're based out of Texas, but we are a national campaign for conservative criminal justice reform. So we handle a wide range of issues, whether it's sentencing, prison reform, and mens rea and criminal intent is another big issue that we've been looking at in North Carolina and a number of other states and at the federal level.
Why is this mens rea issue something that's so important that it ought to attract some national attention?
Right. What's interesting about mens rea, I think Grover Norquist had once joked that, you know, this isn't a new issue because we know that because it's Latin. This is a criminal intent law. It's a really basic tenet of criminal law. But unfortunately, thanks to regulation and sometimes just bad lawmaking, it has become an issue. What occurs essentially is that when there is a crime, there's not enough intent put in the crime. It may simply say, you may not do X. Well, if you do it by accident, then you're also guilty of a crime. But that's not what we learn when, you know, the most basic thing that you learn in law school, which is that every crime must consist of a bad action and bad intent. And now we're going to be convicting people of accidents where we don't really mean to be.
And mens rea, for those who are new to the term and new to the issue, is talking about that intent. This is the intent piece of it,
right?
Not just the action.
Right. Yeah, it's the intent piece. And, you know, we're all familiar with the idea of, say, first-degree murder, second-degree murder. These are different levels of intent. So this is something that even the layperson understands. But for some reason, we sort of lost our way when it comes to making laws where that's just simply either not there or not done correctly.
Now, in North Carolina, is it correct to say that the problem with mens rea really isn't in these areas like murder or robbery, but it's in newer crimes, especially ones that have to deal with the criminalizing regulations and regulation mistakes?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, it's a maxim of law that ignorance of the law is no excuse. But that idea is around the opprobrium of moral crimes, right? These are the things that we're actually concerned about when we say that. But when it comes to regulations, it's very difficult sometimes to really know what is illegal and what is not. And you're absolutely right. When it comes to a regulation that may simply say, you may not knowingly submit this false form. Well, to what degree do you have to know even? Do you know that you mailed it? Do you know that it was false? Obviously, what we're trying to get at is that we don't want people sending in false forms, but there's a lot of things that can complicate this. And unfortunately, that's where we lose our way.
We are chatting with Joe Lupino-Esposito, policy analyst for the national group Right on Crime, also the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. So this is a problem. you're right. looking at in North Carolina. Is this also a problem that we see in other states, that this mens rea or the intent piece of the crime is missing from too many crimes in other states?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, there are two states that took some action regarding this. So most recently in Michigan, they adopted what we would call the default mens rea term. So what they did was, for any laws that did not have a term or if it was unclear, they assigned one of three different levels of either intent, recklessness, or willfulness. So in those cases, rather than just trying to guess if someone was doing something illegal, now we actually know if they actually had that intent. In Ohio, a similar measure was taken where any crime that did not possess a level of intent was assigned a level of recklessness as a level of intent. And further, any new crimes that go on the books in Ohio that do not have criminal intent in there and do not specifically say, look, we mean for this to be strict liability, meaning that there is no intent required, that law is just simply void.
Based on the experiences in other states, do you have a sense of how easy or how difficult it would be for North Carolina to make that type of change?
It can be difficult. And actually, the two biggest things that we found, both at states and at the federal level, our two biggest concerns are, first, a political one. Frankly, it's a lot of folks on the left, people who are environmentalists, sort of anti-capitalists, saying, look, someone needs to go to prison for whatever. Of course, when we talk about other aspects of criminal law and criminal justice reform in particular, we know that just simply locking people up does not really solve a problem. We need to talk about how to enforce laws, and there are other issues involved as well. So that's one issue that we struggle with, sort of a political one. But on top of that, we also just have the legal question. And this kind of comes from all different angles. It comes from prosecutors who say, look, it's difficult to see how we're going to handle this. What could we possibly do if you just pass a default term? We don't know all the laws that are in there and what this will affect. And to that I say, that's exactly our point. We can't just apply it across the board, well, to protect defendants, well, then we shouldn't just be having laws that don't have this intent there. So those are two of the biggest reasons why we have difficulty in doing this. But there are other ways to do it besides the default term. There are things like recodification, where you look at the whole system overall, and you can say, look, we do mean to have certain intent terms for these types of crimes and certain penalties for other types of crimes. And that's really a more holistic way of looking at it and avoiding some of the issues that we've run into elsewhere.
I'm guessing some people are going to hear us and say, this sounds like something of interest to some particular groups of lawyers who are haggling over this. If we did have some type of reform to our mens rea rules in North Carolina, what kinds of benefits would just the normal average person see?
Right. So, I mean, for anybody, either a small business owner or just an individual, there are a lot of crimes on the books in every state. And, you know, I don't need to look at North Carolina code to know there are a lot of crimes that probably should not be crimes. And unfortunately, and it's not imputing any nefarious anything to anyone in particular, but if there is a crime on the books and someone wants to convict you of it and there is no intent, you will be convicted of it. You know, to take a line from one of Stalin's ministers, you show me the man, I'll find you the crime. And unfortunately, that's a situation we are in, especially when it comes to regulations.
So if we see some reform of mens rea, that possibility becomes much less likely to happen?
Yes, absolutely. You know, you won't be seeing those types of issues pop up because it's going to be clear that you're doing something wrong, or there's going to be no way for you to plead ignorance of that law.
Given your experience in other states, even if there is some difficulty in this process, is it likely that people who learn about this are willing to at least talk about it and try to make something happen?
Absolutely, I think so. You know, a lot of folks, no matter what side of the aisle you're on and whether you're more pro-defense, pro-prosecutor, whatever you want to say, the idea is that we want to have justice here. And we don't want to just have people taking away their liberty just because of something that we don't like. The same goes when we talk about nonviolent crimes, regulatory crime. Let's really consider why we're taking someone's liberty away, why we're giving them a heavy fine. Are there other ways to deal with this? Let's look at that and really consider how it can be less damaging but still effective.
One of the things that the John Locke Foundation is recommending is to have just the complete, you mentioned this term earlier, recodification of the entire criminal code. Mm-hmm. Something like that help?
Yes, absolutely. And it really gives the opportunity for everyone to come together, all the stakeholders, law enforcement, you know, defense, prosecutors, everybody can come together and say, why are we really convicting people of certain crimes and to what level we want to do it? Because a lot of times crimes are created and penalties are given, but they don't really match up with other things that are on the books. sort of one of my favorite stories is from the federal level when John Kerry was a senator. And right around the time of the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, he proposed a bill that would make it up to a 5-year penalty for disturbing the Titanic site. Now, not only is that just silly, we'll put that aside for a moment, but there are already laws on the books of disturbing artifacts that had a penalty of up to 1 year in prison. So he's now making a special crime for something that probably shouldn't be a crime in the first place.
One person who's going to be watching closely as North Carolina deals with this issue of mens rea and the prospect for reform is Joe Lupino Esposito, policy analyst for Right on Crime and the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Groups representing retailers and consumers are speaking out against a tax proposal from Congress. Andy Ellen of the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association explains.
It's not often that Washington proposes a new tax, but in case you haven't heard, Washington is proposing something brand new and is called the Border Adjustment Tax, often referred to as BAT. It would create virtually everything, it would tax virtually everything North Carolina families buy today. Groceries, prescriptions, home goods, gasoline, shoes, clothing, you name it, everything you go to a store to buy. It would slap a giant 20% increase on virtually every one of these items that's imported. Added up, experts predict it will cost the average family an additional $1,700 every single year, $1,700 that many families just don't have to spend. Some have suggested that this tax will encourage people to buy American, but that rhetoric, while compelling, denies the reality of our modern global economy. Our economy knows no lines either among states or among countries.
Donald Bryson of Americans for Prosperity also opposes the border adjustment tax.
According to statistics from 2014, the total value of imports coming into North Carolina was around $52.8 billion. That $52.8 billion is equivalent to 11.17% of North Carolina's GDP. That's roughly one-ninth of our state's GDP. Based on our report, these statistics mean that North Carolina ranks 22nd in sensitivity to a BAT. A 20% BAT would lead to $10.57 billion, I'll repeat that, $10.57 billion in new taxes on North Carolina's economy.
Businessman Art Pope explained the negative impact using the example of a $10 pair of pants.
On a $10 sale, cost of goods sold maybe $6. And then you have what you call your operating costs, or SG&A, sales and general administration expenses, which is about $3. So you got a total cost of $9, you have $1 in profit. You apply the 35% corporate income tax rate, you have $1 in profit, the federal government gets 35 cents, the retailer keeps 65 cents. Under the border adjustment tax, though, the cost of those goods sold, that $6, is going to be, quote, added back into your taxable income. So instead of $1 real profit being taxed, your net income being taxed, they're going to tax you on $7. And even at the lower 20% rate, that comes out to $1.40. So instead of paying a 35 cent tax on a dollar profit and $10 in sales, you're paying $1.40, 400% increase. But by the way, your income really is a dollar. So you have $1.40 in taxes on a dollar income, so you're losing money on every pair of pants you sell. That's what's going to force retailers to pass on a huge price increase to their customers.
You've been listening to criticism of a federal proposal called the Border Adjustment Tax, or BAT. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Some state lawmakers are pushing again this year to change the way North Carolina draws election maps, specifically maps for elections to Congress and the General Assembly. Lawmakers draw the maps themselves now through a process called redistricting, but House Bill 200 would change the process. It would set up a temporary appointed commission to handle the task. Republican Representative Chuck McGrady is leading the push for redistricting reform.
When we were in the minority, this bill was something that Republicans generally rallied around. And what I'd say to that is if it was the right thing then, it is still the right thing now. We have to serve the people of North Carolina, and we must make sure that they have full confidence in the integrity and fairness of our elections. Competition is always a good thing, whether it's in business or in elections. So we welcome a better redistricting process that will provide more competition than we have now. When our party, again, was in power, now that we're in power, we seem to have moved somewhat, see these issues somewhat differently. The same was said not that long ago when the Democrats were power. I don't think as a general matter that legislators ought to be, you know, doing their own redistricting. They certainly constitutionally have a role to play. But in terms of how they get the process starts, That's not where we should be.
McGrady and three other Republicans serve as lead sponsors, but Democratic Representative Greer Martin is one of the top advocates for reform.
I have the dubious distinction of being the last Democrat to actually draw legislative districts. When the courts ordered the redrawing of the Pender and New Hanover County districts, I chaired the committee that did that. And shortly thereafter, Chuck's party took control and seized the redistricting pen from my hand. The way we draw districts in this country is a bipartisan problem, and it is so rewarding for me to be part of a bipartisan group of North Carolina legislators who want to be part of crafting a bipartisan solution to it.
Martin doesn't want to overpromise the benefits of redistricting reform.
The bill before you is not a cure at all for the problems of redistricting, at all. But it is a wonderful treatment to a chronic problem from which our democracy suffers. We're never going to have a completely nonpartisan redistricting commission. Redistricting is one of the most inherently partisan activities that we do as a body. There will always be partisanship in it. But this bill will put a layer of insulation between the partisan hacks, like all of us up here, and the drawing of our districts. Regardless of which party is in charge, I think that's the best way forward. This bill is something that we got through a Republican-controlled House, something that when my party was in charge, we never did. And I feel confident that if the planets align, we can get it through the House again, and then it's off to the Senate, and hopefully they'll join us.
Republican Representative John Hardister is one of the roughly 40 representatives, one-third of the state House, who've signed on to the measure.
I think this is the right thing to do. I've thought this was the right thing to do for a long time. I advocated for doing this when my party was in the minority for many years. I wrote letters to legislators. I made phone calls to legislators and said, we need to implement redistricting reform. And it didn't happen. Democrats didn't want to let go of the power. Well, now my party's in power. And I felt like, as it was stated earlier, this was the right thing to do back then. It's still the right thing to do today. So I'm hopeful that we can move this forward. I'm grateful for the primary sponsors of the bill. I'm glad that we're seeing a bipartisan effort to get this done. And hopefully we can get it done. I do want to say for the record, from my perspective, only speaking for myself, that I don't see this as an affront to the current legislative districts that are currently being litigated. I believe, speaking for myself, those districts are constitutional, but I would submit that there's a better way for this process to be done. As Representative Martin said a few moments ago, it's probably not possible to completely eliminate the influence of politics in a redistricting process, but you can reduce the influence of politics in the process, and this is that's what this bill would do. And therefore, I'm hopeful that we can get this done.
The bill spells out details for a redistricting reform plan, but McGrady says supporters are willing to tweak it.
Nothing is absolutely in cement. There are various ways to go about nonpartisan redistricting. This is one way, but it's not the only way. And so we're quite prepared to have that discussion. If and when we can get the bill moving.
McGrady reminded his audience of recent legislative history of redistricting reform.
A bill like this passed the House in 2011 and then hasn't moved in the House in 2013 and 15. So, I mean, it's an uphill struggle. I've always said about the redistricting issue that there's going to be a time when Republicans and Democrats both feel like it's in their best interest to move a bill like this. And I want to have a bill ready and queued up to go when that time occurs. It could occur around a natural, census and redistricting time, but it could also occur around a court decision that might cause people to go, maybe we ought to be doing this a different way.
McGrady says there's an advantage to having a reform bill ready to go.
I came out of the environmental world in doing advocacy. We oftentimes introduce bills because we need to rally public support around the bill. I mean,
most of the time when I did advocacy work, I wanted to create demand for what it is I was putting forward. And so this paints that picture.
What about the complaint from many Republicans that redistricting reform is now a partisan issue? Democrats want it. Republicans should oppose it.
Yeah, I get that. But again, if you have any historical perspective, you understand sort of the shoe was on the other foot at a different point in time. I'd be lying if I didn't say the answer to your question was yes. Some people see that way, but I don't think actually that's the right way to see it. If you've got any historical perspective, Republicans were solidly on a nonpartisan redistricting bill before we were in the majority. Democrats refused to let that move, and now we find ourselves in a different situation. What I'm actually gratified by is that despite that, I've got all Republican primary co-sponsors. Greer stepped aside to even allow extra ones on. I've got people that are in leadership in the House. And so that would suggest that, it doesn't split out exactly the way you've suggested.
That's Republican Representative Chuck McGrady of Henderson County. He's leading the push this year for election redistricting reform. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Parents want high schools to excel so that their kids have the best shot at being prepared for adulthood. Taxpayers, of course, want high schools to do well so that they can see that their hard-earned tax money is being used well. But how do we know for sure that any of this is happening? One measure is the U.S. News & World Report's annual ranking of high schools in America. Dr. Terry Stoops, who is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research and the Director of Education Studies, is here to share the data on North Carolina. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us about the top five high schools in North Carolina.
Well, the top five high schools in North Carolina, according to U.S. News & World Report, are all schools of choice. And that really mirrors what's happening nationwide. If you look at the national ranking of the top high schools, it's the same deal, is that we have a lot of charter schools at the top, a lot of magnet schools, a lot of alternative schools, but they're all schools of choice for the most part. Now, that doesn't mean that the whole list, of course, is full of just schools of choice, but it does mean that not only in North Carolina, but nationally, that the top high schools are schools where parents get to choose to send their children, whether it be a magnet school, which is the top school in North Carolina, the Philip J. Weaver Center in Guilford County, or a charter school such as Raleigh Charter, which is also up there in the top five, or an early college at Guilford, which is also at the top five. These are the different choices that North Carolina parents have, and of course, they're making their mark in performance on these rankings.
Who or what do these five schools have in common?
Well, they don't have a whole lot of common, to be honest, except that they're schools of choice. Some are in urban areas, some are in suburban areas, and some are even in distant areas, like Thomas Jefferson Classical, which is in Rutherford County. This was not what you would call an inner city school. So you see that they are scattered about at different places in different counties with very different demographics. There are some of these schools that have almost no disadvantaged students, and then you have some, like Thomas Jefferson Classical, that has a decent population of disadvantaged students. And that's one of the things that this ranking looks at. If you look at the methodology that the U.S. News and World Report employs, they look at student performance, but even beyond that, they look at student performance at disadvantaged groups. These are low-income students. These are African-American students, Hispanic students, and how they perform on state tests. So it's very important that these schools are reaching out to different populations. They provide parents choices in different ways, and they're located in different areas in the state.
Now, this is fascinating to me because it sounds like they really don't have a whole lot in common. So what should we draw from this, Terry, that the top five high schools in our state happen to be schools of choice? Is it coincidence? Is there some nugget to be drawn from that?
Well, I think what choice does is it gets parents involved. And the one thing we know from the research is that when parents are involved in the education process, the performance of students increases. And the way you get parents involved is to give them choices, make them sit down and decide which school is best for their child. When you start taking decision-making away from the parents, you automatically, in a lot of ways, remove them from the process, and you make them believe that the education of their child is being handled by someone else, or someone else is taking care of that issue. Getting them involved is what's absolutely critical, and that's what choice does. And so when you start providing choices, and it doesn't have to be in the form of a charter school. It could certainly be within the traditional district system, like a magnet school, or even providing choices within that system. Parents are more involved and student performance thrives.
It's interesting because it's really buy-in is what you're talking about. The parents have bought into this, and we try to teach this to our kids a lot of times. The classic example that I would take away from this is when you have a teenager who wants a car, and you say, well, that's fine. Mom and dad will pay for half of it, but you've got to go get a job and save your own half. They've bought into the process, and somehow it's more meaningful to them when they actually do get that car. Is that essentially what's happening here?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. And, you know, some of it, too, is that you have more affluent parents who are more involved in their kids' education. You certainly have instances of that in some of these schools. But if you look at Thomas Jefferson Classical Academy, for example, you definitely don't have that. Rutherford County is a low-income county in a fairly rural part of the state. So you don't have that same level of parental involvement than you would have at, say, a Raleigh charter or at an early college at Guilford, which are in the top five. And if you look at some of the other schools in North Carolina that are, say, in the top 20, you have a lot of schools from the traditional district system, East Chapel Hill High School, Carrboro High School. But you also find that there are a lot of charter schools represented, Franklin Academy in Wake County. You have Greystone Day School. So there are plenty of other charter schools, even in the top 20, but also you see a lot of traditional public schools also represented.
You mentioned Raleigh Charter High School, number two on the list of the top five in North Carolina. That school just kills it every year, it seems like.
They really do. They really do. And, you know, that's what is really important about having any school that's high achieving is the expectation that it will continue to achieve at a high level. Now, Raleigh Charter certainly attracts a tremendous number of applicants. In fact, it's one of the hardest things to get into Raleigh Charter High School because thousands, literally thousands of applicants vie for a very limited number of seats. So getting into Raleigh Charter is very difficult to begin with. And that just speaks to the quality of the school. It also speaks to the fact that we could have probably two or three more Raleigh Charters and we could fill them up instantly. And that's one of the difficulties about charter schools is that we don't have the opportunity to replicate them as quickly as we would like. Because if we did, we could have Raleigh Charters that would accommodate thousands of more students and hopefully accommodate them at the highest level that we have the current Raleigh Charter High School.
Terry, I think you've just given us a really good reminder about public charter schools. How do people get in?
Well,
you just apply and it's a lottery?
That's right. If the applicants exceed the number of seats, you have to be chosen by a lottery. Now, that's not a rule that's universal 100% of the time, because there are charter schools that are allowed to use a weighted lottery, which means they can choose students from certain demographics first and then choose the other students via lottery. But Raleigh Charter has to choose their students by state statute via a lottery. So they can't pick and choose who comes to the school and who gets a seat. This is true for charter schools across the state. It would be easy for any charter school to just take the cream of the crop and enroll them in the school. But I think the people who created charter schools in North Carolina did not want that to happen, and that's not what happens. You have to be chosen by a lottery, which is a random process.
And Terry, if we broaden out to the United States, the data in this U.S. News and World Report is rather interesting, because traditional public schools did quite well.
They really did. And, you know, the state that did best was Arizona, a state I know that you know very well.
Yes.
The Arizona charter schools in particular have really separated themselves from the other public schools in Arizona. A tremendous system of charter schools, the Basis Charter Schools in Arizona is the name of the group of charter schools that really excelled and year after year find themselves at the top of these kind of rankings.
Well, what I love about a list like this is that it's certainly not the be-all and the end-all, but it is a good indication, just one more piece of data that parents and taxpayers can take a look at and see what it means to them, if it's helpful to them. We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, a recent promotion.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And also the Director of Education Studies. Terry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. We hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.